Listen to the voices of our world.
It's clear that our policy in the region is about something bigger than just this so-called war on terror.
Those within the administration figured that, well, we're this far, why not move on and achieve some other goals, such as greater control over the oil region?
If the United States can control the Persian Gulf, it'll have its hand on the jugular of the rest of the world.
Welcome to Voices of Our World, a presentation of this station and Mary Knoll. I'm your host, Eileen Bott. In the life of an individual, and in the history of a nation, there come along what one may think of as diving board moments. I mean those crucial moments leading to that point of no return. The moment after you've jumped up and down several times on the tip of a diving board, thinking through your intention, until you're at that Rubicon millisecond, suspended in midair, when it becomes irrevocably clear there's no going back. Not even if there's no water below. As a nation, we had a diving board moment when our leaders took us to war against Afghanistan, not Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and when we went to war against Saddam and Iraq, not Osama. So today we'll look again at the push for war with Iraq and what may in fact signal a Bush-Cheney design on an expanding domination of the Middle East, including forcing a confrontation with Iran. Today we'll talk with two internationally respected journalists and authors, Robert Dreyfus and Peter Arnett.
One is a genius, the other's insane.
It was a very funny, satirical cartoon series, written clearly for an adult audience. Pinky and the Brain was spun from the more mischievous side of Uber producer-director Steven Spielberg. The duo, a pair of lab rats, were a skinny simpleton rodent, sounding like a cross between Stan Laurel and Dudley Moore. Pinky, and his Svengali-like leader, a shorter and rounder vermin with a voice meant to mimic the late Orson Welles, the Brain. Not quite so funny. I can't possibly be the only person who sees a resemblance between Pinky and the Brain and our real-life fearless leaders, Bush and Cheney. At the beginning of each episode of the cartoon series, Pinky would ask the Brain,
"What are we going to do tonight, Brain?"
And the Brain would always answer,
"The same thing we do every night, Pinky. Try to take over the world."
The comparison is feeling less and less funny to me. Recently, for TomPaine.com, Robert Dreyfus wrote, "The attacks of 9/11, the 21st century's Pearl Harbor, allowed Vice President Dick Cheney, along with Paul Wolfowitz, Doug Feith, John Bolton et al., to steer President George W. Bush and the U.S. government toward a global war. The invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, the endless war on terrorism, and the militarization of American foreign policy." Some have traced the neocon petroleum pursuit all the way back to the writings and speeches of American-educated Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu, considered the real father of the war on terror doctrine. In a piece written for the July-August issue of Mother Jones, Dreyfus tells us that Elizabeth Cheney, the vice president's daughter and a top State Department official, has created a brand new office of Iranian affairs at State and supervises an office called the Iran-Syria Operations Group. Robert Dreyfus is a contributing editor to Rolling Stone, The Nation, and Mother Jones, and the author of The Devil's Game, How America Unleashed Fundamentalist Islam. Kathy Golden recently talked with Robert Dreyfus about his article in the July-August edition of Mother Jones magazine. Next, we take Tehran and what may be our country's next diving board moment.
It's clear that our policy in the region is about something bigger than just this so-called war on terror. And it's no surprise that so many of the fighting wars that we're engaged in are somewhere in the vicinity of the Persian Gulf or Central Asia because of the energy supplies. And what I believe is a primary motivation for our involvement in that part of the world, but also specifically in relation to the confrontation with Iran, especially as the rest of the world, China and India and other parts of the third world, begin to develop industrially and start to build highways and build automobiles, you're going to see the demand for energy in those parts of the world start to come up to approximately the level of that in the United States. And if the United States can control the Persian Gulf, it'll have its hand on the jugular of the rest of the world.
Now, Bob, the particular article that you've written recently for Mother Jones on Iran, you go into great detail about alliances that have been building all along between Russia, China, and Iran. So wouldn't the United States be privy to the same knowledge you are, and wouldn't they be thinking, well, the ship has sailed?
Well, Iran is really a battlefield. In a way, it's up for grabs because it's a small country. Now, it has an enormous amount of the world's oil and gas within its boundaries, and it also sits in a very strategic position in terms of dominating the rest of the Persian Gulf, and specifically the mouth of the Gulf through which all the oil tankers pass. But it's still a weak country, and there are a lot of great world powers that are struggling for influence or even control in Iran. China is going to become the world's greatest consumer of oil and natural gas fairly soon because of their voracious demand for these fuels. So the Chinese have built an organization called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that includes Russia, and it includes four Central Asian republics, the STANs, and they've recently been offering membership to Iran, and it's kind of meant, I think, as a counterweight to NATO or to the Western economic alliances, trying to link these energy-hungry nations like China with the energy supply nations like Central Asia and Iran. And it's clear that it's meant as a deliberate counterweight to the United States. So the struggle over the Gulf and Iran has international, that is, global dimensions that go far beyond simply Iran's efforts to acquire nuclear technology.
In looking back at the run-up to the second Gulf War and where we are now in Iraq, at this point in time, what would lead Bush to believe they could actually get away with starting another war of any kind in Iran? Tony Blair can't possibly think that this could fly.
Well, that's a very good point, but I'm not sure that they're seeking war with Iran in the immediate future. It could happen. The Israeli invasion of Lebanon and the carnage there has escalated the crisis to the point where the Israelis have put confrontation with Syria and Iran back on the table. And sure, we could wake up tomorrow and find out that either Israel or the United States or both have launched cruise missile attacks and bombing raids against Iran's nuclear facilities. But I think much more you have to think of it as a fork in the road. A couple of months ago, it looked like some of the adults in the Bush administration, like Condi Rice, just like Colin Powell tried before her, tried to steer the United States back onto the path of diplomacy and negotiations. And, of course, they launched that famous opening to Iran for diplomatic talks. That was opposed by Dick Cheney. The neoconservatives denounced it as a sellout, as a blunder. So the other path in the fork in the road is the path of confrontation. And whether that means war sooner or later is up for grabs. I mean, I put in my article that Bush might attack Iran before the election. He might wait until next year, or he might simply continually just kind of escalate the showdown over things like sanctions and embargoes and, you know, stirring up resistance, revolts inside Iran among ethnic and minority groups. There are a lot of things that are options short of war as well. But I think it's more constructive to think of it in terms of the path of confrontation versus the path of negotiation. And down that confrontation path is where the neocons want to go, again, in pursuit of unilateral American hegemony in that part of the world.
But now back to what you were saying about the forks in the road, et cetera, and where we're going. And one wonders when you see them pandering to James Dobson's crew and the left behind folk, do they really, really want this? Is what we see now in the Middle East, is that part of the orchestration?
Well, definitely there's an affinity among both the neoconservatives and the Christian right, what's sometimes called the Christian Zionist, for Israel. And I believe that what Israel is doing is partly an attempt to outflank the moderates in the Bush administration and to re-energize both the neoconservatives and the Christian zealots to allow them to come back to the kind of prominence they had between 9/11 and the war in Iraq in March of 2003. That was their zenith, their high point. And as the war in Iraq began to go awry and bog down and then finally descend into this murderous, horrible carnage that we see every day, they began to lose influence in the Bush administration. And I wouldn't be surprised that even Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld himself is, you know, sort of had it up to here with the advice of people like Paul Wolfowitz and Doug Feith, who are no longer at the Pentagon. So there's been a kind of eclipse of neoconservatives in the Bush administration. And I'm concerned, of course, that they're going to try to make a comeback. And if they do, there's no telling where it could lead. But certainly confrontation with Iran is one sure bet.
And Seymour Hersh has written on these subjects as well. And he's said that we already have folks inside Iran. Is there any evidence that that is the case?
You know, I've read what Tsai has written, and I'd have no reason to doubt it. I think it's probably right. On the other hand, you know, we have CIA people all over the world doing their skullduggery, and so it doesn't necessarily follow that we're planning an attack. It could be anything from intelligence gathering to simply, you know, building up allies and assets on the ground to maybe even some covert operations aimed at destabilizing Iran a little bit, but I don't know that that necessarily implies that we're going to launch massive bombing raids. But of course, if we do, one of the things that the neocons are counting on is that these bombing attacks, which would probably last, you know, many weeks and would have repeated strikes at up to 50 different sites where there's nuclear research going on, they're counting that these would have an enormous effect inside Iran, would shake up the regime, would create some sort of chaos there, after which I guess they hope some sort of government more friendly to the United States would come into being. I mean, I just don't see the logic of it. It seems to me that not only would it strengthen the regime if they're under attack, but also if a new government did come to power, it would be more hostile rather than less hostile to the country that attacked it. So I don't know, but I suppose if we do go to war in that sense, that it's good to have, you know, from their point, good to have CIA people on the ground to try to, you know, push their candidates to, you know, take power, to exercise influence and so forth. But to me, it seems like an utter fool's game.
Unfortunately, again, you are probably right. Robert Dreyfus, June-July issue of Mother Jones, Next We Take Iran. Fascinating stuff, and thank you so much for talking with us today, Robert Dreyfus.
Thanks, my pleasure.
If the United States government is considering pursuing an expanded war in the Middle East in the name of the war on terror, are you with them or against them? Email us at radio@marynoll.org or go to our website, www.voicesofourworld.org. Just click on Contact Us or call us at 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARYKNOLL. You're listening to Voices of Our World.